This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Ben Kingsley entered the consciousness of American movie audiences in 1982 as Gandhi, with his Oscar-winning performance in the title role of Richard Attenborough's film. Since then, Kingsley has shown his versatility as an actor and earned three more Oscar nominations for his roles in Bugsy, Sexy Beast, and The House of Sand and Fog. Among his many other films are Betrayal, Schindler's List, Dave, and Oliver Twist. Kingsley is currently appearing in The Whackness, where he plays a pot-smoking psychiatrist who treats his teenage dope dealer, and in Elegy, where he plays David Kepesh, a college professor in his 60s who falls in love with a former student, Consuela, played by Penelope Cruz. The film is based on the Philip Roth novel The Dying Animal. In this scene, Kepesh is talking to a friend about having slept with Consuela. The friend is played by Dennis Hopper.
Well, she must have been curious about going to bed with you. Yeah, so she could tell her girlfriends what a man of our age is like close up.
I'm in your experience for one of many to come. She remember me as the old guy who gave her some culture on the way.
Well, that sounds about right, and you should chalk it up to the same thing, right? Yeah. Gotta stop worrying about growing old. Worry about growing up. Thank you, lucky stars, for such a one-shot encounter.
It wasn't a one-shot encounter.
Well, Ben Kingsley, welcome to Fresh Air. I wanted to talk about your new film, Elegy. Why don't you describe the character, David Kepesh, the professor?
He's an intellectual. He's very literary. He writes articles for magazines. He's a critic for the theater in magazines. He has his own radio program. He has his own TV program. In his own world, he's a bit of a star. He's also a professor of literature at a university in the New York area. He lives in Tribeca. He has a rather bachelor apartment. He's a serial seducer, and I think he's a serial seducer because he's rather committed to staying alone. I know that's a paradox, but he won't commit. He won't commit because as I played him and I studied him and I got into his skin, it's clear that he's a man really threatened by intimacy. He will not let anyone, any woman, get too close. And when the gods look down and see a man like this, I think the gods want to challenge this, and I think the gods insist that this man moves on, grows up, crosses a certain bridge that he needs to cross in order to join the human race.
You know, a professor who hits on his students is, in the eyes of many people, a pretty low form of humanity. And we should say that this particular professor, David Kepesh, is careful to wait until the class has ended, so he's not technically going after someone that he still has an academic relationship with. But
that is correct. And in David's defense, it takes two to tango.
Of course.
So the girls also hit on their professor. And so however you judge that, you're free to judge that.
Right,
but I never judge my characters. I just put them in front of the audience and say, okay, boys and girls, you make up your own mind. But it's so beautifully resolved. Yes, of course, it's not a low form of life. I would say it's a rather immature form of life. And he reaches a kind of greatness in himself when he does quite wonderfully finally commit to this relationship, and she, of course, commits to him.
You know, one more thing I wanted to ask you about this.
Yeah.
The character David Kepesh here is based upon a Philip Roth character. He was at the center of three Philip Roth novels. Did you read those and draw upon them, or do you prefer to work from the screenplay and the director and see that as an independent work?
You're absolutely right. I prefer to work from the screenplay with the director. I feel that our director, Isabel, was so immersed in that Roth novel, so enamored of the script and so articulate in her exploration of male vulnerability in a way perhaps that only a woman can be, a woman celebrating male vulnerability, as perhaps a male director might see that vulnerability, as David does, as a flaw, as a weakness. Isabel Cosette, our director, celebrated the discovery of that vulnerability in him and the exposing of it. The novel I read whilst filming, but I didn't read it before and I didn't pick it up afterwards, but I did see, I did watch, was a documentary made on Philip Roth in New York, made by a German friend of mine, Christa Marker. She's a very good documentary filmmaker. And I really enjoyed watching that documentary film, and I felt that Philip Roth and I could stroll through Central Park and have a really nice afternoon together, chatting. And I loved his use of language. He's very expressive, quite a vulnerable, dignified man, charming. And I also am happy to tell you that he has seen the film and that Philip Roth likes the film very much indeed.
Huh, always a relief.
Yes.
Another recent film that's now in theaters is The Whackness, which had to have been a fun role for you. You play this psychiatrist, Jeffrey Squires, who treats a young teenage drug dealer played by Josh Peck, and the psychiatrist takes payments in nickel and dime bags. I thought before we talk about the character, we'd just get a little taste of some of their conversation. This is I think this is the cut where Jeffrey Squires, your character, the psychiatrist, is talking to Josh Peck about some of his problems, that being particularly not getting enough friendship from the ladies.
Great.
I've been thinking about your dilemma a lot recently, Luke.
What's my dilemma?
The girl thing. Luke, back when I went to school, drug dealers had no problem getting girls. In fact, that's why I always wanted to be one.
Were you popular in high school, Dr. Squires?
Well, I wouldn't say popular. No, I wasn't one of those cool kids, if that's what you're asking. I played baseball. I was a debater.
Did you ever want to kill yourself?
Not till much later.
Then you must have been popular. I'm not.
This has got nothing to do with being popular, Luke. You're just not trying hard enough. You must think about it. The different scenarios. Random sex in phone booths. Chance encounters in discos. The way they smell. The things they say. Even when they're saying nothing at all. I mean, I'm married, so I don't contemplate that type of thing.
No. Of course not.
That's our guest. Ben Kingsley, portraying psychiatrist Jeffrey Squires, dispensing advice maybe not out of the manual to his young friend. Tell us about developing this character. It's just – it's so – well, you've played so many different ones. Tell us about this one.
There's a recklessness to him, and I wanted to bring a recklessness to my performance, whereas Capesh is somewhat studied and careful. I pursued a kind of recklessness. I wore a wig, which I very seldom do in films. I often have my own shaved head. But it looked as though my brain was growing through my skull, and it was rather messy and fuzzy, this halo of fuzz, permanent fuzz around me. And I also was rather endeared and amused by the fact that whatever Dr. Squires does, it looks as though he's doing it for the first time, even though he's almost habitual and has done many things many times. Talk to patients, smoke a bong, try and talk to his wife, try and listen to his daughter. Everything he does has the hesitancy of a child doing something for the first time and the wonder. And I wanted to immerse him in that characterization as well, in that world as well. So
talk a little bit about the voice. I mean, it's such a New York voice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was quite daunted by the fact that we'd be filming in New York and also, of course, surrounded by New Yorkers. But I did manage by osmosis to listen a lot. I'm a good listener, and I've got a reasonable musical ear and a reasonable ear for accents. So being in New York filming was a great gift to the film and to me personally. Then I remember a voice from an actor I greatly admire, and used his voice as a kind of starting point, and then bounced off from there.
Well, you're going to tell us who that is?
I'd love to. It's Joe Mantegna.
Ah, Uh-huh. People have compared you a little bit to De Niro there. No.
Good heavens.
Good.
I hope not too unfavorably.
You know, you're thought of as you know, a classically trained British actor. So good with words and with dialogue, and this has such a breezy feel to the dialogue. Did you improvise in doing this?
No,
this film?
Not one syllable. Not one syllable. I loved what was on the page. It comes so much from Jonathan Levine's experience and vernacular, and of course we were surrounded and immersed by that strict 1993-94 era of early Giuliani years and the hip hop era and rap emerging, and therefore I felt, as that's so specific, as is my usual wont, I stuck very, very close to the script. I think I might have changed one word, but that's about it. I love bringing the page to life. It's my early training, as you say.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your career. You spent a lot of years on stage, and I know did a lot of things. But then there was this incredible role of Gandhi, which I know it's like a lot of years back in your life now, but it's it was Best Picture, Best Actor for you, introduced you to the world that many that didn't know you. How did you get the part?
Well, I'm seeing Richard Attenborough in 2 days as Chancellor of Sussex University. He's giving me a doctorate in literature, DLit, which is thrilling. Not ever having been to university, I'm now acquiring a string of honorary degrees behind my name. Uh-huh. And Dickie Attenborough was guided towards me by his son, Michael Attenborough, whom I'm also going to see in a couple of days' time. And Michael saw my Hamlet. So there's a direct line between my portrayal of Hamlet for the Royal Shakespeare Company and my portrayal as Gandhiji for Richard Attenborough. It was because of my Shakespeare work, perhaps also that Lord Attenborough, Dickie, knew that I possibly would have the stamina and the discipline to carry a massively heroic and epic role, comparable to King Lear in Shakespeare's Lear. Comparable to Hamlet. In fact, it has been said that if history had not invented Mahatma Gandhi, Shakespeare would have done.
Huh.
Or Tolstoy, or some great epic writer, because it was an extraordinary life, and I was immensely privileged and thrilled to be a part of that, the telling of his story.
Do you see a connection between Hamlet and Gandhi? Do you see the thread there?
I do. I see a thread between Hamlet and Gandhi when you scrutinize under the microscope Hamlet's great dilemma, which is to be or not to be, is it really worth carrying on living? And if so, we must fulfill our destiny and not live a half life. And I think Gandhi was constantly questioning himself as to the validity of existence, of his existence, and what he could accomplish within the span of his mortal years. I'm sure he would have gone on to accomplish more during and after partition, but of course, like other extraordinary leaders after him, notably JFK and Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy, he was shot.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read some reviews back from 1982 when the film was released, and it was very interesting. This was a role that got you the Academy Award for Best Actor, and of course it was Best Picture. But it's interesting to read that the reviews describe you as an Anglo-Indian actor who had a remarkable resemblance to Gandhi. Now, I know you were born in England. I think your parents are born in England, although your dad, I guess, is of Indian descent.
That's right.
I wondered if kind of that characterization of you as someone who is an ethnic fit and who looked like Gandhi in some ways felt maybe – I wondered if you felt you weren't getting – enough credit for what was really an incredible acting performance.
I think for a little while it troubled me a little bit. I remember somebody at a party, an English woman actually, at one of the receptions after the screening of Gandhi, and I'd done 15 years with the Royal Shakespeare Company before then, and she said, "What happened? Did he just find you? implying that he might have found me, I don't know, driving a cab. Right. But that brings me back to
you found a Gandhi lookalike, in other words, right?
Thank God I did those years in the theatre where I could not have taken one step or uttered one syllable in that film were it not for my classical training. Look, if I'm damned with making it look easy, that's one of the crosses I have to bear. But I think that that Betrayal, directed by Sam Spiegel, was in no way as large a film as that. But Sam did open that Betrayal film the day I was nominated for Gandhi, and it did, for me, provide a balance and slowly but surely work towards, with a more varied repertoire, a finer balance and a more perceived balance until, thank God, I played Don Logan in Sexy Beast, and then, et voilà, people either thought I was mad, bipolar actor I was called, or I was actually quite good at my job, but there was a divided camp as to whether I was bipolar and needed help or whether I was actually quite good at my job.
I want to get to Sexy Beast and some other work, but I want to just spend another moment on Gandhi, and I think we ought to just recall a bit of that performance.
Please.
Let's listen to a little bit of Gandhi, and I don't know if you have a favorite scene, but I thought I would play the one where you were in South Africa addressing the rally.
Wonderful.
This is Gandhi's earlier years, when he's actually in South Africa, and this is a rally called Against a New Law, which would have required Indians there to carry a special ID card. And he has risen, as some others in the event have advocated violence against the South African government, and Gandhi responds. Let's listen.
In this cause, I too am prepared to die, but my friend, there is no cause for which I am prepared to kill. Whatever they do to us, we will attack no one, kill no one, but we will not give our fingerprints, not one of us. They will imprison us, they will fine us, they will seize our possessions, but they cannot take away our self-respect if we do not give it to them.
Have you been to prison? They beat us and torture us. I say that
I am asking you to fight. To fight against their anger, not to provoke it. We will not strike a blow. But we will receive them. And through our pain, we will make them see their injustice. And it will hurt, as all fighting hurts. But we cannot lose. We cannot.
And that's our guest, Ben Kingsley, portraying Gandhi in the film, the 1982 film, Gandhi. You know, here you are in this film. You have to portray a giant of the 20th century, but also make him a human being with a temper and a family and a sense of humor. You want to talk a little bit about how you prepared to play the role?
Well, I know that I'm going to shock a lot of people, but my preparation was minimal because I left the Royal Shakespeare Company performing Baal on stage in, I think it was October, and we started filming in November. I went to India. I lost a lot of weight. I acquired a deep tan under the Indian sun. My Indian genetics were dancing in the Indian sun. I learnt my lines so that I was word perfect on a beautiful script. And in that speech that you just very kindly played for your audience, I can tell you that my voice is shaking with emotion because of the faces I was looking at in the crowd. Not because I thought, what a wonderful actor I am and aren't I being moving. No. All I had to do was deliver that speech and look at the faces of some amazing Indians in the crowd who, as you heard, stood up, joined in, applauded, contradicted me, pleaded their case to me about how savage the treatment was being meted out to them. But honestly, standing on stage delivering that speech to a room full of Indians was completely transforming.
There were so many small moments too. I mean,
yes,
like you spinning a thread.
Yes.
Did you actually learn to do that?
Yes. Mr. and Mrs. Hande used to come to my hotel room in the early hours of the morning. I used to have spinning lessons every day. I think my record was 7 unbroken minutes of spinning on one take, and I'm very proud of that. I do my own stunts, Steve McQueen and me.
And did doing that stunt, did spinning the thread actually add something, you think, to the performance?
Oh, I mean, yes, this is so.
The private Gandhi, the one who...
Very much so. It added, it gave me a perception, an insight, physical insight, because it's not an intellectual I don't find acting an intellectual process. It's a physical, visceral process of how patient he must have been, because I believe that he was able to spin for hours without snapping the thread. And that requires very steady breathing. It requires an absence of anger or any interference of rage, because he must have been enraged sometimes by what was going on around him.
If we fast forward 20 years, we get to an amazing performance in the film Sexy Beast, where you play this criminal, Don Logan, who comes to visit an old friend, played by Ray Winstone, to convince him to get involved in a bank job. Winstone's happily retired in Spain with his wife and is there with some friends. And my heavens, you're scary. I thought we'd play for the audience a moment here where you, you've had several conversations and your old friend, Gal Love, has told you he's not interested in doing this job and you simply won't be turned down. This is you as Don Logan.
Do it. I'm retired. Do it. This is madness. I've had enough of this crime and punishment bollocks. I'm happy here. I won't let you be happy. Why should I? Friday, the Grosvenor, you'll be there.
I won't.
You will. I told Ted you're doing it. Don't you show me up.
No, I won't be there.
You will. You're Mr. Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Roundtree.
No.
Yes, Grosvenor.
No, Don.
Friday.
I won't be there.
You will.
No, Don.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that is Ben Kingsley playing Don Logan in the film Sexy Beast. This is, you know, this guy is so terrifying. When he spends a lot of time in this film with four other people, intimidating and menacing them in a way that made me squirm in my seat. Tell us about this guy.
He jumped off the page for me, because when I read the script, I saw that the script was written so beautifully and structured so well that it had the structure almost of a Shakespeare play. So I was able to, just on reading, draw an immediate parallel and thread that joined Don Logan to Iago in Othello and all the great Shakespearean and Jacobean villains, Richard III, something inside him being crippled, something inside him longing for love, and something inside him refusing to take no for an answer when he asks his friend to join him. So I was confident to a certain degree that this was a beautifully constructed part. I could push and pull and kick Don Logan in all directions, and his central strength as a character would hold. And whilst playing the role, I was deliberating on this terrible need he has for love and this violent way of expressing it. And I came to the conclusion that he was an abused child. And I saw Don not... I didn't see him primarily as a man of violence. I saw him primarily as a profoundly abused individual who would mete out revenge for that abuse to the rest of the world for the rest of his life. And I'm afraid the unhealed abused child does become an extremely violent adult.
You know, you said in a moment when we were off the air that I think you don't particularly like looking at this. He's the performance, because Don Logan still terrifies you.
Well, there are parts that of him that frightens me. I actually quite love watching the film, but I tell you the bit that really did frighten me was when I had to act in the mirror. He was shaving and talking to himself in the mirror. I think that was the one time where I turned to the director and said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to take a break and come back and have another go. And I just had to walk around for a bit and come back to the mirror. And every time I looked in the mirror and saw the monster that I was creating, the portrait of the psychopath, sociopath, in the mirror, I found it very disturbing. But then I took a deep breath and we got that in one take, and the director said, I don't want you to do that again. So I didn't. But being him was empowering. Seeing myself as him in the mirror was terrifying.
Well, you know, and that raises another thing that occurred to me. You have four, you know, very fine actors here in all of these scenes with you. But If I were in those scenes, and even if I knew it was you, Ben Kingsley, and even if I knew you were acting, I think it would still scare me.
Yes, maybe. Ray was very generous towards me in the way that I was describing how generous the Indians were. Because Ray Winston is pretty well acquainted with a certain part of London life that is dangerous, that has a particular vernacular, that has a particular style, a particular gait, a particular walk, a particular rhythm. And when I arrived in Spain to work with them, one of the first things Ray said to Jonathan was that he knew my character. He said to Jonathan, I know who he's doing. I know who Ben's doing. I know him. He's a driver. I know him. I know his name. I know where he lives. He was so generous to say to me, coming from a very different discipline from Ray's, and I admire Ray tremendously, he said, you've got it. You've got it. You've got him. I know the man. I know this man that you're playing. Didn't go into any details, just in case. But,
Wow.
Very generous.
Wow. Did you have to prepare for the role physically? Because, you know, you look really rugged and tough in this. You know?
Yeah. My body changes. My physical shape changes from character to character.
Well, by working out or by your will or your will? What? How does that happen?
It's subliminal. I have a different posture. My character has a walk and posture that becomes quite different from character to character. I don't know how it happens, but it just does. And I was very happy with the makeup department who turned my face into something slightly more like an axe, a weapon. And then the wardrobe department, they said, what do you think? And I said, I think he's got 10 shirts that are the same, 10 trousers that are the same, 10 black shoes that are exactly the same, and some jackets. And that was it. I presented that silhouette to the camera, and the camera accepted it. And Jonathan Glazer was wonderfully accepting of what I'd arrived on the set with.
You know, this violent character came 20 years after portraying the world's most famous pacifist in Gandhi. Did it change your career in any way?
Don Logan?
Yeah.
Yes. It did. I think I was referred to as bipolar actor at one stage.
You were knighted in 2000, became Sir Ben Kingsley. What did that mean to you? Was that important?
A lot. But I have to put it into context. The British are very different from the Americans in expressing their enthusiasm, and very different from the Indians that we were talking about earlier. Walking into a restaurant or down the street in New York with my darling wife, Daniela, is a treat because we're greeted very warmly. Taxi drivers roll their windows down. People stop when it says don't walk, and a little collection of people around me saying that they'd seen this and that, and could I sign this for them? And in England, we're completely ignored. It is a bit disconcerting. You think, oh, don't they like me? Don't they? Don't they love me? Don't they? No, we're here. It's as if one's invisible. Walking into a restaurant, people hide discreetly behind their menus and whisper. And it's odd to go from one environment to the other. But then with this reticence, you almost think the British hate success. You begin to really worry that they will never enthuse. And then one day you get a letter from the Prime Minister inviting you to the palace, which basically says, we have seen you, we have heard you, and we do love you. It is completely overwhelming. Coming from that context of almost feeling invisible, and from your own country to embrace you in that way, your own language, for me it's quite beautiful.
Gosh, an Academy Award, 4 Oscar nominations, not quite enough. not in England.
Not in England, right, it isn't.
Right.
With all due respect.
Well, you know, I guess I should. I thought I would finish by noting that you, Sir Ben, recently appeared as in The Love Guru, the Mike Myers film, as Guru, what, Tuggin' My Puta?
You said it, not me.
let's listen to just a bit of this and then...
I'd love to.
Okay.
Deepak, why do you want to join the Tuggin' My Puta ashram?
To seek my true self.
All right, kiss ass. Maurice, why do you want to join
I want to become a guru so girls will like me. Then I will like myself.
Deepak, you will enjoy love in all forms. Maurice,
you must wear this chastity belt.
Chastity belt? That sucks.
What got you into this completely over-the-top role with Mike Myers?
Mike Myers is delightful. And he does have a quite a tough discipline on set, which I find totally admirable, which is that he has to run the films the way Charlie Chaplin ran his films in the black and white days. If you're delivering a comedy to the audience, it has to be consistent in style. The same joke has to be explored in the same way. The rhythm has to be consistent. And Mike on set is inspiring to be with. He's a lovely guy. And he has great authority on the set, and I loved that consistency. Also, it gave me an opportunity to go mad, to be completely balmy, to be reckless. I did stay word perfect on my dialogue. I did, but it gave me an opportunity to be careless, and really it allowed me to stretch myself and find some areas of fearlessness in front of the camera. And being ludicrous in front of the camera, which I think I needed to do. I need to do this more. Just start to be a little less careful about my work.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Ben Kingsley, it's been so much fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ben Kingsley's new film with Penelope Cruz is Elegy. Harps and Angels is Randy Newman's first album of new songs in 9 years. In recent times, Newman has concentrated on composing movie soundtrack music. He won an Oscar in 2002 for Best Original Song from the movie Monsters, Inc. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Newman's new album is a mixture of the kind of music Newman has been writing for the movies and his earlier, more darkly satirical material.
Anybody see me lately? I tell you why. Anybody see me lately? I tell you why. I caught something made me so sick that I thought that I would die. And almost did too.
Am I the only one who still gets goosebumps hearing Randy Newman stab at his piano and sing in that sly, slurry way of his? I hope not. That title song from Newman's new album, Harps and Angels, is a mini-epic, written in the voice of a man who has a near-death experience. He receives a visitation from either God or St. Peter, who encourages this lazy reprobate to live better and to believe in an afterlife. But this being Randy Newman, I have to add, sort of.
Table, but keep your business clean. Lay you on the table, but keep your business clean. Yes, there won't be no harps and angels coming for you. Be trombones, kettle drums, pitchforks, and tambourines. Sing it like they did for me. I spoke French, so actually the main thing about this story is, for me, there really is an afterlife, and I hope to see all of you there. Let's go get a drink.
One unfortunate decision on this album is the prettifying of the song A Few Words in Defense of Our Country. When Newman rushed that composition out onto iTunes as a single in 2007, sitting alone at his piano comparing America's future to the fall of great empires, it was written in a simmering fury at U.S. foreign policy and the current Supreme Court. Now, rearranged for an orchestra and framed as a cowboy's lament, the song loses a lot of its power. I get the freshly added joke, George Bush as cowboy, cowboy as emperor, but it flattens the fury. As social commentary, a newer song included here, a piece of the pie, about our wobbly economy, now seems more jaggedly pointed.
Like it's all you want, the very best of life. Car, house, a neighborhood that's nice. Flowers, cheese, and lots of little kids around. Where public schools are breeding grounds for vice. You say you're working harder than you ever have. Say you got two jobs and so's your wife. Living in the richest country in the world. Wouldn't you think you'd have a better life?
The clashing atonal chords of A Piece of the Pie enhance the song's message while never sparing anyone, not even the composer himself, with the line, "The rich are getting richer, I should know." Which brings up the perennial Randy Newman question, is he singing his own sentiments or those of a character he's created? Harps and Angels offers examples of both, and therefore isn't going to assure any puzzled newcomers to Newman's music. This collection has its by now token bit of outrageousness, something Newman has tacked on to most of his albums ever since Short People became a freak hit single in 1977. The new version of this is Korean Parents, about how the title figures push their kids too hard academically and thus pushes a racial stereotype into satire. I'm not going to play it. You hear the premise, you get the joke. What I will play, though, is a foray into misogyny, placed very carefully into the mouth of a gabby guy. It's called Potholes, a reference to the dips in memory that allow this fellow to selectively forget his worst sins and mistakes.
I love women. Have all my life. Love my dear mother. I love my wife. God bless her. Even love my teenage daughter. There's no accounting for it. Apparently, I don't care how I'm treated. My love's unconditional or something. Been hurt a time or two. I ain't gonna lie.
At age 64, Newman no longer seems concerned with appealing to a mass audience. He's content to bat out stuff like movie tunes. He's always taken a craftsman's satisfaction with formal challenges, no matter how slight the project. And the money from that may have helped finance the orchestra for Harps and Angels, with its frequent, defiantly unhip Dixieland arrangements. If that makes it sound as though I'm consigning Newman to the scrap heap of pop, far from it. He's as vital a cult artist as any such person 40 years younger, and it sounds as if he's got a lot of genial bile left in him, which is pretty thrilling. Like I said at the top, goosebumps.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Randy Newman's new album, Harps and Angels.
Satisfaction guarantee. Getting everything you need and deliver. Why discreet? Cause you're on easy street. Any place you wanna go, we'll call ahead. Let them know. Get you into the back door. Get a front row seat, cause you're on easy street. Are your old friends? I know you love them so. It's gonna break your heart, but won't have to let them go. Your friends up here must be the elite. You like everyone you meet on.
That's Easy Street from Randy Newman's new album, Harps and Angels. Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who died on Sunday, will be buried tomorrow in Moscow. Our critic at large, John Powers, has these thoughts on the man and his legacy.
In the seemingly endless run-up to the Beijing Olympics, the media keeps fretting about its coverage. Would it be rude or even wrong to criticize China's human rights abuses or its support for ghastly dictatorships? It's too bad that nobody asked Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel Prize-winning writer who died over the weekend. I'd love to have seen his look of disdain. From the beginning, Solzhenitsyn's sense of righteous purpose made him more than a little daunting. With that aggressively unflattering beard and stark refusal to smile, he made Orwell and Camus seem about as serious as Groucho Marx. He belonged to the grand tradition of visionary Russian artists, from Tolstoy and Dostoevsky to Andrei Tarkovsky, men whose missionary zeal could border on the mystical. Solzhenitsyn's mission was to expose and conquer Soviet communism. He was well motivated to do it. The party had stripped him of everything. Born a year after the October Revolution, he was fighting the Germans in World War II when he got locked up for some flippant words about Stalin. He spent the next decade in prison and internal exile, eventually writing about his experiences in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. This was the most earth-shattering, meaning the most realistic novel, ever to have been published in the Soviet Union. Its success made him a target, but he persevered. He worked 16 hours a day for years on the Gulag Archipelago, his anatomy of a system in which lies became the pillar of the state. He kept a pitchfork by the door in case the KGB happened by. As with many great artists, Solzhenitsyn's specialness lay in his ability to articulate what those around him more or less knew, but couldn't or wouldn't say. For starters, he had moral courage. Having faced down war, prison, and cancer, he had the fortitude to keep writing, all alone, against the world's biggest police state. But bravery alone won't get you the Gulag Archipelago. It takes vast intelligence and imagination. Solzhenitsyn had to dig for every piece of evidence, often at great personal risk, then put his findings in historical perspective, and then bring his stories alive. He could sometimes be a dreadful writer, especially later on. But he could also be brilliant. No one who's read him will ever forget that scene when a party member proposes a toast to Stalin, and the whole audience keeps applauding and applauding because everyone's terrified to be the first one to stop. Like so many saintly sorts, he wasn't especially likable. He could be prickly, sanctimonious, a crank. Even fellow dissidents chided him for his vaulting egomania. But really, how could it have been otherwise? To stand up against the steamroller of a system that's flattened tens of millions of lives, you need more than your fair share of sheer cussedness. This made him a pain, and not only for the left, which resisted facing the hard truth of what Solzhenitsyn had to say about communism. On the right, Henry Kissinger convinced President Gerald Ford not to meet with the writer because his political views were, quote, an embarrassment. That is, they didn't serve realpolitik. Of course, once Solzhenitsyn was exiled to American soil in 1974, he did behave like an ungrateful guest, constantly scolding the West that welcomed him for its materialism and spiritual emptiness. Oddly, he seemed to think that suffering in a Siberian camp was somehow nobler than listening to the Beatles. In 1994, he returned to Russia as a culture hero. But it's the fate of heroes, those who live long enough anyway, to watch the world move on. Just ask Mikhail Gorbachev. Or Brett Favre. Eventually, he came to be seen as less a prophet than a monument, one occasionally bespattered by cultural pigeons enjoying the freedoms he helped give them. More often, he was simply ignored. If he cared what the world thought, he didn't show it. For better and worse, he always knew that he was right, even when he wasn't. Still, when it came to the matter on which he will be judged, the calamity of Soviet communism, he was clearly on the side of the angels. So much so that he soared free of the prison walls of powerlessness to become one of the essential figures of the 20th century. In his novel, The First Circle, a prisoner says, "You only have power over people so long as you don't take everything away from them. But once you rob a man of everything, he's free all over again." It was Solzhenitsyn's great triumph that he didn't merely write these lines. He proved them.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.